The Spinoff Podcast Network. Skinny are helping you show how smart you are with the 1Q Quiz, an all-new, super challenging and super quick daily quiz built by The Spinoff. Every Monday, Skinny are giving you the chance to prove you're smart with the Skinny Extra Credit question. Get it right, and you'll get the chance to score yourself some Skinny Extra mobile credit so you can text, call, or even video call your group chat and gloat about how big your brain is. T's and C's apply.
Raising capital or taking your business to the world? Investment Fix has everything you need to make it happen. This season, we're exploring the US market, the opportunities it offers, what it takes to grow a business there, and the best way to approach investors. The Investment Fix podcast. Tune in today.
And welcome to this extremely special episode of On The Rag, proudly brought to you by The Woman's Bookshop. Now, we have an extremely iconic guest in our midst. Most of you will probably know who she is, but before I introduce her, I implore that you all check out www.thewomansbookshop.co.nz or visit them IRL on Ponsonby Road for each and every one of your Christmas needs. We're all on the same page on
we're
that,
doing
right?
I'm doing all your Christmas shopping. At store. Yep.
Buy yourself a lovely felt suffrage brooch.
Yeah. Why wouldn't you?
Is there a men's bookshop?
Sounds a bit sexist to me.
And there she is. It's Clementine Four. I mean, I have written a proper introduction for you. Shall we do it?
Yeah, do it.
Okay.
Do it.
Embarrass her.
I've used your own Twitter bio in it.
So. That's all right.
So in a moment of bottled lightning, we have our first ever returning international superstar guest. She's a twice published best-selling author, a leading social commentator, an evergreen yas queen, and an unfuckwithable feminist demogorgon. It's Clementine Ford!
What's a demogorgon?
Kia ora.
I don't know. It was in your bio. You tell us.
The Demogorgon is from Stranger Things.
Oh yes,
the monster from the upside down.
Yes,
got it.
So as you devour small children, or
just the male ones,
only a few times a week, you know, watching my figure.
It's just breakfast. So you're in the country. You're promoting your fabulous new book, Boys Will Be Boys. How's it been?
It's weird to hear international guest in Aotearoa and practicing decolonizing
my family, right? You married into New Zealand, didn't you?
Yeah, well, I'm not married, but into New Zealand.
Yeah.
I love it here. Mm-hmm. You know, every time I come, I think, maybe I should move here.
We wouldn't be against that.
We'll keep your
no
chair
resistance,
free,
honestly. For that.
Now that, Jacinda Ardern is Prime Minister as well.
Yeah.
You know, what's...
Our Prime Minister's better than yours.
I know. It's Who
true.
Is your Prime Minister right now?
how would you know? What day is it?
Also very exciting news. Sorry, Clementine.
Oh, no, I was just going to say something about our Prime Minister's a total fuckhead.
Yeah. Fuckhead, there we go.
Yeah.
We got it. It's a fuckhead count number one. Clementine has also just joined our private Facebook group On The Rag 24/7.
Yeah.
I feel like a milestone.
It's pretty good. It's good. Yeah, I feel the quality of that page, which was already extremely high, has gone up.
I don't know.
Higher.
I feel like I lower the tone quite a lot, but I'm going to be in my game now.
I think balance is good.
I'm excited. I'm excited to get in there and see what's happening.
It's a beautiful, wholesome place on the internet. People just share, like, just things to make your day better.
Oh, that sounds so nice.
And questions. Genuine questions.
Struggles. Conundrums.
Stuff that is unrelated to, like, feminism as well, but
perfect.
you just need, like, a supportive group to get you through it, which I really love.
Because feminism, you know, it is a lifesaver, but it can be exhausting too. Mm, you know, sometimes you do just, someone got angry at me the other day because I hadn't, you know, I'd failed to appropriately condemn the Greens throughout the state election because the Greens have been mired in, you know, lots of really terrible behaviour, overlooking sexual harassment in some of their candidates and, you know, covering up rape allegations, et cetera, like really bad stuff. But, you know, it's the end of the year. I'm exhausted.
I
want to have a drink.
You know, and also, but they were like, you can't
tweet anything bad about the Greens because you don't want to put off your base. You want to keep selling your books, but you can find time to tweet about The Bachelor.
It's like, yeah, sorry, sometimes I watch TV.
And also sometimes I feel like, you know, you're a doctor of some kind and you specialise in rheumatism and people go, why don't you do enough about fasciitis? I don't know what I'm talking about. But, you know, like you can pick your battles, right?
Yeah. Well, and also no one can A, comment on every single thing happening in the world, or certainly B, hope to be an expert on every single thing happening in the world. You know, this is the whole point about having a choir of people that contribute to activism, is that sometimes when you are either too tired or not equipped to make comment on something, this is when other voices that are better placed to do so, you know, fill in the chorus.
Mm. Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Now, Clementine.
Yes.
What we've done is dumped every single question we've ever wanted to ask you into a Google Doc, including a lot from our listeners. But I first wanted to ask you, so last night you were on The Project. We love The Project here at On The Rag. You've never been on The Australian Project.
I've been on The Australian Project in the talking heads thing that they do, where they send a camera crew to your house and you have to do your own makeup so you look, you know, half dead. And you know... Most importantly, do not get paid for it. Mm. I've never been on the desk in the Australian Project. I feel like I'd be really good at it.
You were wonderful. I just found that quite shocking. I said, why are they not letting you on as a leading social commentator?
I don't know. I feel like I should have a regular gig on that.
Because it's quite progressive, right? The Australian one. Isn't that why we started one over here? Because it's sort
of fairly... I think it's fairly left-leaning, look, I'm not sure. I don't know. Maybe they don't think
Buck up your game, Australia.
Mm. Yeah.
What surprised me as
maybe
well.
Maybe not blonde enough, although I am pretty blonde right now.
It surprised me that you were sort of introduced as, I think, their most controversial guest ever.
In like last night.
Very divisive.
I must just tune out now whenever anyone uses that description about me because I hear it all the time.
And I was just sitting on my couch being like, are you? Do you see yourself as a divisive sort of figure of controversy?
I think that claiming to be controversial means that there's some sort of element of cynicism to the work that you do.
Mm.
If you're being deliberately controversial, then you actually don't care about the issue. You're just trying to rile people up, which sometimes is fun, but I don't think that that's what motivates me. But I just think it's really easy to, you know, whether or not it's feminism, whether or not it's civil rights, whether or not it's, you know, being an activist on gender issues, whatever it might be, anything that challenges the status quo and that makes people angry and that makes some people who have historically held a lot of power feel like they might be losing it. Anything that makes them feel uncomfortable is framed as controversial. And because I'm not the kind of feminist, as none of us are, because we're not the kinds of feminists that like softly be really nice and sweet and make sure that you provide the disclaimer all the time that, of course, we're not talking about any of the men in this room. Of course, we know that most men are wonderful, amazing people, and they'd never, ever hurt anyone, and they'd always, always speak out against misogyny and sexism. Because I don't do any of that, it's comes across then or people willfully misinterpret it as being, oh, well, she's just, you know, she's just bolshy and she's just a man hater and she's just controversial. It shouldn't be controversial to say, hey, one woman every week in this country, in Australia, is being murdered by a man.
Yeah.
Mm. It shouldn't be controversial to say that. It should be controversial that that's still happening.
Yes. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. Someone told me last year, someone who I love very much, described me as radicalized. And I was like, what the fuck? It was really shocking to me that someone could, like, as far as I'm concerned, I get paid to, like, point out stuff that's real obvious that people have maybe not thought about. But it's obvious stuff. Like you say, it's like it's the statistics are what are shocking. Or with what I do, it's like the history of colonization in this country is what's shocking. Me pointing that out. It's not radicalized.
No, it's pretty often, and like what both of you have just done is pointing at data. And so, you know, that's not radical or controversial.
Yeah.
I like strident. I've adopted strident as my adjective,
which is a nice word.
But it does blow me away that you might be the most controversial guest, given that a couple of weeks ago they had a flat earther on.
Wow.
Well done.
Yeah, well, apparently it's more controversial to, you know, yeah. want humans to grow up in a world oh. that is free of patriarchy. Yeah,
oh, my God.
Wow.
I'm so sorry.
See, I really like the word uncompromising. That's my word
oh, that's
now.
Good.
Because ooh. I feel like it's not, it doesn't play into any kind of stereotypes around, you know, it's there's nothing feminized about it, yeah. you know, whereas women are often described as feisty or
yeah, strident,
you know,
shrill.
Bullshit, yeah. strident, shrill. Whereas uncompromising can be yeah. applied to anybody. And it's sort of, it really kind of like outlines exactly what it is. I'm uncompromising on the fact that I want to live in a world where, you know, women and children aren't being murdered by men.
This is great. I'm adopting that. That's now my adjective, it's everybody.
Good.
I'm just announcing that now.
It's
I'm,
the first call to
we're getting matching tattoos.
It's good. Yeah. right after this. So boys will be boys. What does this phrase mean to you? Your first book, obviously, Fight Like a Girl, took that phrase and put a positive spin on it. Mm. Boys will be boys. What is the real meaning behind that phrase?
Yeah, so the two book titles, you know, I took commonly used phrases and tried to repurpose them into meaning something different. So whenever we say like a girl, you do something like a girl, we know that that generally means that you're rubbish at it. Or you're weak, or you're somehow, you can't do it as well as anyone else, of course, being boys. So I tried to repurpose that into something positive. Whereas boys will be boys is a quote unquote positive phrase often used to excuse behavior in boys that is, you know, anywhere on a scale from just sort of roughhousing to actually criminal, and assign really negative qualities to, explain away really negative behaviors to some kind of innate state of masculinity that is not only impossible to be changed or challenged, but also something that we should enjoy, you know, that we should admire little boys that are like, oh, boys will be boys. Oh, he's pushed you over in the playground. Oh, he's such a boy, isn't he? Oh, boys will be boys. Or, you know, a girl being sexually assaulted at a party where she's been drinking and she's wearing certain clothes. Oh, well, what did she expect? You know, boys will be boys after all. All of these things are, as we all know, extremely negative. So I wanted to take that phrase and repurpose it again to show or to explore what is actually being said when we make that excuse or when we use that to minimize the impact of men exerting patriarchy on the women and children around them. Mm. And, you know, so the book kind of goes from it sort of takes a linear fashion in that it looks in the very first chapter at how we code gender in children even before they're born and how we assign stereotypes along with assigning sex. So the way that, the way that boy children will be spoken about or will be treated by the people around them or the clothes that they'll be either forced into or not allowed to wear based on what people think is acceptable for boys and acceptable for how boys exert their personalities. And then how we use that to create the groundwork later on for behavior that becomes in some circumstances much more damaging and much more concerning and, as I said before, sometimes criminal. Mm. So, you know, the most recent example of that, which isn't in the book because it was published before this happened, was the appointment of Brett Kavanaugh on the Supreme Court. That the fact that what was being described, not only was Dr. Christine Blasey Ford, of course, not really believed by any of the people who had power to put him on the Supreme Court. And if they did believe her, they didn't care.
Mm-hmm.
Or they didn't want to care. But also there were excuses being made amidst the media commentary and the public commentary for what happened, you know, that they were teenagers. What did she expect? This is what boys do. You know, I remember that there was one really concerning article interviewing five Republican women.
Yes, I saw.
Yeah.
Where they just went, oh, that happened to all of us. That's just what happens.
Oh, and one of the Republican women essentially said, well, this is just what boys do.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's interesting. I think we even talked about this the last time I was on, that people say that feminists are the ones that demonize men and we're the ones who claim that all men are rapists and that, you know, we hate men and we never see the good in them. But there's nothing more there's nothing that says more that all men are rapists just looking for an opportunity mm-hmm. than phrases like boys will be boys mm-hmm. or what did she expect or why was she drinking yeah. or, you know, why did she go into a room with him or, well, this is just what boys do. Yeah. Like, it's actually conservative ideology that frames male behaviour as being...
as monsters unless we yeah. stop them being monsters.
Unless women mm. constantly act as the gatekeepers of sexuality. And actually in Australia, one of our most reprehensible columnists there, Miranda Devine, who is just probably actually a goblin, you know, wearing a suit of human skin. She wrote this disgusting column after, as this was all happening, because, you know, she's a pick me girl, you know, she wants all of the boys to know that she's on their side.
Right.
And she wrote this column in which she said that, firstly, she completely derided Dr. Blasey Ford for the way that she was dressed on the at the hearings, that she made some sort of snarky comment about her professionally blow-dried hair, as if she turned up with, you know, sort of an unwashed, untamed barnet that. People wouldn't have made a big deal about that. Oh, she's not believable. Look at how she's yeah. dressed. She can't even brush her hair. About her simpering, childish voice. You know, it really, like, tore her to shreds.
What the hell?
And then she sort of finished the second half of the column by saying, even if he did do all the things that she says that he did, so what? That was the phrase that she used, so what? It's and essentially implied it's not that big a deal. It wasn't like he actually raped her. He didn't succeed in doing it. And that now that Dr. Blasey Ford is somehow ridiculously saying that she lives with anxiety and she needs to have, you know, two exits to any room and, you know, that this is just, this is absurd. And this is essentially what I got from reading the column was that she was trying to imply that this was not an issue of a sexual assault that has caused lifelong trauma in a woman, but a woman who is so fragile and unable to cope with the realities of life and with the reality of male, ordinary, normal male behavior that she's mm. mentally disturbed now and she is untrustworthy in that respect.
Wow. Okay, so I'm feeling the rage now. And making sentences is beyond me. The thing about your book and a lot of the things that you say is it's so clear and it's so calm and it's so neutral and it just makes me furious. And did it make you furious to write the book?
In parts, yeah, parts of it definitely. I mean, some of the book is a bit more lighthearted and yeah. I tried to include a lot of humour in it because I knew that people couldn't read about all of these terrible things yeah. without having some levity. I found it – I was really gratified after the book came out that people did report that they found it funny because I think I lost sight of the humour while I was writing it. I tried to put it in there, but I was so stuck in the monstrous parts that I was worried that it was just so dark the whole way through. But, yeah, there were definitely times during the writing of it where, you know, I would spend weeks writing a chapter about rape or weeks writing a chapter about the family court and how actually, you know, there's this myth, and I'm sure it's the same here, this myth that the family court is, you know, overrun by feminist judges, like any part of the legal system is run by women. Overrun by feminist judges that are just working to destroy the family unit and to steal children away from their fathers. When actually the reality in Australia, at least, is that the family court is so heavily weighted in favour of fathers and fathers' rights that women are advised now to not, advised by their lawyers to not report suspected abuse of children because they will be painted as hostile parents and risk having their children taken away from them entirely. And these were changes that were instituted by John Howard during his reign of terror that had sort of – the Keating government had kind of paved the way for them back in the late 90s when they adjusted some of the laws around determining child custody, where they basically made it so that they ruled that the ideal situation would be for children to have contact with both parents, as opposed to just this blanket rule that children would automatically go to their mums. John Howard introduced the friendly parent provision, which essentially enforced that parents had to prove themselves friendly to each other in order to resolve a conflict in the family court. And because mothers were often the ones who were, there are any number of reasons why women might end up in the family court fighting to maintain custody of their children, a very, very tiny percentage of which I will acknowledge is to exert some power over the father. But that is a minute percentage. In the majority of cases, it's being driven by issues of family violence, issues of intimate partner violence, suspected child abuse, or just complete inability for the father to take care of the children by himself. Mm. But because these changes were introduced, it has made it now really, really difficult for women to fight for their rights in the family court. And yet we still maintain this mythology that the family court is designed to, you know, persecute dads. I mean, and as I say in the book, you know, if all of these fathers who suddenly pop up in the family court afterwards and decide that they want to have 50-50 custody and then get mad at their ex-wives for keeping their kids from them, you know, where were they beforehand wanting to do their 50-50 share?
I was just going to lighten it up by bringing in David Seymour. So have you on Twitter, we've ACT Party leader.
Oh, I did see the ACT Party's tweets the other day. I'm assuming it's a party of one.
It is. And, you know, he spent a lot of his time as an MP twerking on national television on Dancing with the Stars. So he's got a lot on. They sort of collated.
Well, they didn't. That's an old one. Yeah, so
they didn't even do the work themselves.
Oh, no, what? They didn't. They
For
didn't.
God's
well,
sake.
That's not unsurprising.
Not surprised, but disappointed nonetheless.
So, there's that the collage of tweets that, you know, are many years old of all the times on Twitter. And there's what? There's like 12 of them.
Yeah.
So the hundreds and hundreds of times on Twitter that I've said
you made a joke.
Yeah, made a joke. A variation on kill all men or
I'm embarrassed
whatever.
For them that they've not only missed the fact that it's a joke, but used something that's really old.
Well, I mean, it's just
they didn't even make themselves.
It's a collage,
it's a
that
used meme
constantly. It's posted on everything. Yeah. That I, you know, everything to do with me, any event I'm doing, someone will post that. Because of course, you know, you can talk about beating women and, you know, how do you tell, you know, what, oh, that's how the jokes always go. women deserve equal rights and left and, you know, get back in the kitchen and make me a sandwich or, you know, what do you tell a woman with a black eye? Oh, nothing that she hadn't heard before or something, whatever it is. You know, those are all hilarious, really original as well jokes, you know, and you can joke about raping women. You can joke about all the things that actually happen to women every day.
Yeah.
And that's not a big deal because it's just words. It's just funny, you know, just get the fucking sand out of your vagina and have a laugh.
Yeah.
But if you joke about something that is demonstrably not a problem in the world, i.e. feminists rallying to murder all of the world's men, this is deeply, deeply serious and a sign of your ultimate plans.
Well, don't worry, David Seymour's on it. he's gonna sort it out. So I understand there has been, I mean, as you mentioned, everywhere you go, there's a kerfuffle.
Yeah,
in the MRA sort of realm. I'm assuming it's MRAs, or is it just kind of egg avatar people,
you know,
on Twitter?
It's hard to tell with men's rights activists whether or not they're just. I mean, because MRAs, some of them are committed, some of them do sort of work very hard at their cause,
right?
And then others are just dickheads, I think, you know. And it's difficult to tell with MRAs because men, generally speaking. Men who are a part of the MRA movement, generally speaking, are quite disorganized. We had a men's march in Australia recently. You know, a march for men's rights because men were being so grotesquely demonized in the media, apparently, in the weeks after.
That's so sad.
Yeah, in the weeks after the rape and murder of Eurydice Dixon, who was a young female comic who was raped and murdered while she was walking home from work one night. Men had to put up with weeks and weeks of commentary in the media about how maybe the problem of men's violence should be solved by men. And so this the March for Men's Rights was organised because it was just so horrible, all the, you know, indignity that men had to suffer through. And it was organised by a woman.
Ah!
Yep.
Was she somebody's mum?
No, she is a young woman in Sydney who is couching herself as a conservative commentator. Mm. She makes YouTube videos. So she's really, look, she's really jumping on the back of, you know, wanting to be someone like Lauren Southern, yeah, who, you know, tried to come to New Zealand, or to Tommy Lauren, or mm-hmm. Ann Coulter, you know, this sort of like small contingent of conventionally very attractive women who appeal to very kind of like misogynist, sexist men by saying, we're on your side. We love you. We're not like those horrible, ugly, hairy feminists.
I have a big gun.
And then the men go, see, I told you.
How could I hate women? I'd love to have sex with that woman. So she organised it, and they're all like, you know, oh, we need more women like Sydney Watson. So, you know, I think about 100 men turned up.
they attempted one, that march on Parliament, that got no media coverage whatsoever.
Oh, was that
three
men? King of Kings?
No, Return of Kings.
Return of Kings.
God. I think they got three or four people show up. And,
dear.
The police had sort of been alerted that there was going to be, and then they were like, oh, don't worry about it. There's no one there. Well, everyone go home.
Yeah, I think that the event that I'm doing tonight has had some, you know, threats of protests. And
peaceful protest.
Yeah, well, they've organised. Organised a couple of security guards and some police, and they informed me that, don't worry, we're taking care of you. We're going to have some security guards, and I was like, honestly, don't need to bother. There's no one's going to be there, and if there is, it'll be one guy with a sandwich board.
They're very poorly organised.
On a side note, why do their websites always look so bad? Who's designing this?
This is men's issues with a Z. Oh. Always with a Z as well.
It's interesting, actually, because there's an American sociologist called Michael Kimmel, and he wrote a book called Angry White Men, which is sort of similar themes as Boys Will Be Boys, but, you know, written from the perspective of obviously someone who has a lived experience of being a man. And he also went into communities of angry white men and tried to sort of like get to the bottom of what their issues were, let's understand them kind of way, but, you know, exposing, he's really invested in exposing toxic masculinity. And he profiles this father's rights activist in, you know, in this book, who is heavily involved in, you know, groups like A Voice for Men. I don't know if it's that specific group that he's involved in, but heavily involved in online men's groups where they talk about the indignities that they suffer at the hands of the family court, etc. And there's just this moment of terribly sad irony where Michael Kimmel speaks to this guy's son and says, you know, so, because occasionally he gets to spend time with his son. And he says, oh, you know, so do you get to spend a lot of time with your dad? Do you enjoy, you know, what kinds of things do you do? And he says, oh, you know, not really, because he's so busy with his online groups. So this,
his father's rights, so he hasn't got time to be a father.
But this is what I think it actually comes down to, is that, like, the whole, like, my kid has been taken away from me and I need to have my kid back so I can spend more time with my kid, is obviously a truism for some men. Mm. But for a lot of the men who are very, like, hyper-involved in these sort of, like, online communities and in this sense of activism, this is what they care about. Yeah. It's not actually about their children at all. Yeah. It's about being part of a persecuted group of men who they can kind of, like, flex their muscles in front of and speak freely about, you know, how much they hate women in a way that they sense that they can justify. I mean, Paul Elam, who started A Voice for Men in America, which is kind of considered the you know, he's sort of considered the grandfather of men's rights activism. One of his major issues is father's rights. And, how, you know, he's talked about how judges who sit in the family courts should be immolated, basically, and, you know, the terrible damage that they do to dads, and, you know, how much men suffer at the hands of this legal system. And then last year, BuzzFeed, two reporters at BuzzFeed released this amazing expose on him, which basically revealed that not only was he a total deadbeat dad to his two children, but that he opted to walk away when they were kids. He left the mum and then came to a settlement in a custody settlement where he said that, you know, he'd be happily have nothing to do with them. And I think he gave them like $2,000 in child support for the rest of their lives. That was it.
Oh my God.
And then when his daughter reached out to him when she was an adult with children of her own and tried to sort of reestablish a relationship with him, that, you know, they did that briefly and then she cut off contact with him because she saw him smacking her son one day. So okay. This is – it's all a lie, you know. It's all a facade so that they can – it comes down to that sense of, like, men – part of masculinity or part of toxic masculinity and its role in patriarchy is providing hierarchies for men to sit on. It's about their scrabble to the top of the hierarchy.
Right.
So some men's rights activists are deeply incensed that they don't sit at the top of the hierarchy anyway, but that also what's keeping them back, what they perceive as keeping them back from elevating up the hierarchy now is not patriarchy, it's not
women.
It's women. Yeah. It's women and women's rights.
I mean, that's exactly true of the whole incel movement as well, right? It's the hierarchy of women having sex with men that aren't us.
Yeah.
We deserve for women, but conventionally attractive women.
Yeah.
Not the women who sort of.
None of the fuggos.
That are socially aligned with what we are like. We want the attractive women, and if we can't have them, then they should be murdered.
Yeah. And punished. If not murdered, then punished.
Yeah.
Because I need to put my and it's all, you know, I'm going to use some real cis-centric language, but I need to put my dick in her to prove my manhood to other men, you know. And, yeah, these, particularly in the incel community, women have ceased to be, if they ever were, humans, that they're just benchmarks to how their own masculinity is defined. And how dare these women have the right to deny their masculinity.
Dare they be so fucking discerning, I think is how you put it in the book.
Dare they decide who they want to have sex with. But, you know, it's also interesting as well is, like, it speaks – I mean, incels is, like, the worst kind of extension of this mentality. But it also speaks to how differently male – again, cis-sexist language, but male and female sexuality is kind of framed in the world that we live in, that sexuality and sex for men is still spoken of and considered to be something essential to their identities, you know, that men need to have it not only because if they don't have it, they physically hurt, but that also if they don't have it, they're emasculated.
Can I ask you a question about men? Because I don't get them. So in the 70s, women started working on – consciousness raising because they understood that the patriarchy wasn't giving them a fair deal, right? So women have been organizing groups and reading and talking to each other and learning to understand the system that oppresses us. Men are sort of aware that the patriarchy is not working for them because they die early and they self-medicate and they have heart attacks and they don't get time with their children and they have appalling family lives and all that. But they don't fucking get together unless it's in a toxic way, in an MRA kind of a way where they're just, as you've said, repeating the patriarchal structure within that forum. But men haven't still got together to do some consciousness raising about how the patriarchy isn't working for them. Why?
I think, you know, there are small groups of men who are doing that work. And I find that really encouraging as well. And I think that, you know, if in Australia we have something called men's sheds. Do you have that here?
Yes, we were talking about
that. I just saw it the other day because I took a photo of one. My parents live in quite a small rural town and I was out with my dad and I was like, what the fuck is that? And then his explanation of it was actually really nice.
Yeah.
Like I was really into it and I was not prepared for a description of a group for men. The men's shed where my parents are from is actually run by a woman who's the head carpenter within that, that group.
Oh, that's so cool.
It turns out the working men's club in the same town is also the chairperson as a woman.
Yeah. I wonder if it's something that's more prolific in like the regions or something where it's like harder, I don't know, like less connection in like rural. I'm assuming you're talking about the place I'm talking about.
In the Wairarapa, the heart of the Wairarapa. Yeah, the idea that there was a place for men to create and contribute positively because they might be isolated from friends and family.
So is that part of that idea that men don't really like to sit face-to-face and talk to each other, but they like to stand shoulder-to-shoulder and do something while talking to each other?
Yeah, I think maybe that's the idea.
I think it also breaks down – I mean, my understanding of men's sheds in Australia is that, you know, yes, stuff happens in the shed, but it's very explicit that the purpose of it is for men to get together and talk about their feelings. And a lot of these men may be of a particular generation where they certainly haven't been encouraged to discuss their emotions and to speak about their feelings in that way. But they also may have been, you know, they may have gone through divorce or they may be widowed. And one of the things that patriarchy does to, you know, particularly sort of mainstream heterosexual couples is that, and particularly men of over a certain generation, is makes the women the sort of vestibule for men's feelings. Mm. You know, so we all have lots of networks of women that we can speak to and, and offload to and kind of nut out things and explore our emotional landscapes with. But generally speaking, patriarchy has encouraged men out of that. And again, like men over a certain generation don't talk to each other about what's going on in their lives. I mean, one of the most horrifying statistics I've ever heard, and again, I have to double check this because I read it a while ago and I need to check the source on it, but it I know it's sort of roughly correct, is that for men, older men particularly, whose wives pass away, the average time for them to get remarried is 9 months, which is, and it's not because they don't love their deceased partners. It's not because they're not still grieving for them. It's because they don't want to be alone. And they, it's partly, I think, that they don't want to be alone because in some cases it would be that they don't know how to take care of themselves because their wife has always done everything for them. But it would also be because they don't have anyone to talk to. You know, and
deposit those hopes and dreams and feelings.
Which is incredibly sad. And yet at the same time, women for too long have been the sole recipient of men's emotions. And I don't know if any of you ever feel like this, but I just can't do it, you know. I just feel like sometimes, you know, sometimes even with my partner, I'm just like, oh, can you just go out and like find some men to talk to about it?
Stand in a bar or play a game of golf and have a chat.
I'm not equipped to receive these feelings, you know.
It reminds me of like in the BFG when the dreams get sucked into those jars. It's like you feel like you're just constantly absorbing the good and the bad. I just wanted to give a shout out. I had to Google just to check his name, but that cool barber guy who's driving around New Zealand in his van with a pure pure motive of just speaking to men about mental health and giving them a free haircut, kind of like a sharing economy kind of a thing. His name is Sam Dowdle, sorry. And he is so awesome. And I've seen a lot of – he's had a lot of media and stuff, and it seems like wherever he goes – men are just dying to have a conversation with this wonderful man.
And there is that thing, isn't there, that, you know, once somebody's touching your head, you are open to
– secrets come out.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, one of the things about I remember going, like years ago, going to a conference through the Australian YWCA, and there were representatives – it was a world conference, and there were representatives from all countries all over the world, and there was some women from – oh, I think it might have been Uganda. They're repping the Y there. And they were talking about one of their programs was to take condoms into hair salons and to talk about sexual health in hair salons in this sort of private space where it was only women there. Because this is where women went to talk about shit, basically. And in Australia, I think that there's been some programs beginning lately or some funding for programs that will train hairdressers to talk about domestic violence with their clients. Because
that's so great.
Wow. Yeah, because that's amazing. Like, because this is actually like a perfect place for people to come and have these kinds of discussions.
Yeah, totally.
And reveal slowly what's going on in their lives, you know. But see, the thing is, like, I think that's great about, you know, go around and talk to men about their mental health. That's wonderful. Like, men need to be encouraged to speak more openly with other men about mental health issues. But the problem is that it can't just be done as a thing of like, well, let's get men talking about mental health and how we can feel better about ourselves. It has to be done in conjunction with A, recognizing that the impact on men's mental health comes from patriarchy. The the education about not discussing it comes from patriarchy, but also it has to go in tandem with talking about gender equality, because it's not that those two things are part of the same issue, you know. For men to really kind of like, for men to shuck off the lessons that they've learned about themselves through patriarchy and its sort of construction of masculinity, they also have to recognize how those things impact women. And there's no mental clarity for them or mental happiness if they also require the women in their lives to maintain the same roles that they always have done.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
We need to burn it all down. Yeah. Oh, we need to burn it all down. We often talk on this podcast about being caught in those situations where you hear something sexist or you see something sexist or you get kind of caught in an argument and you lose all your stats and facts and cool little sayings. Do you have like particular things that are just your go-to when you get stuck in those situations, especially the whatabouters or the I've never experienced sexism, therefore it doesn't exist kind of people?
Oh, if someone said I've never experienced sexism, therefore it doesn't exist, I'd probably just say something like, oh, congratulations, but just because it doesn't exist for you doesn't mean it doesn't exist for anyone else, you know. I've never seen a Tasmanian devil, but I'm pretty sure they're real.
Prove it.
But I heard a really good one the other night, because normally my go-to would be like, oh, I'm sorry if you, like if someone says something sexist or racist or homophobic or transphobic, whatever it might be around you, you can say, I'm sorry, I didn't hear that. Can you say that again, please? Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then you get them to repeat it a second time so that they are aware that it's actually really shameful what they've just said. Or you can say, like if they've tried to make a terrible, you know, oppressive joke, you can say, oh, I don't get it. Can you explain it to me?
Why is it funny? Is it because women are dumb?
But then I heard this great one the other night, which is that you just go, oh, I'm sorry, I've just got something a bit sexist stuck in my ear. Can you just say that again? And that works for everything too. I've just got something a bit racist stuck in my ear. I thought that was brilliant when I heard that. So I can't lay claim
That's
to that.
Very good.
That was brilliant. Neve in Wellington who told me that.
Oh, shout
That's
out.
Great.
Shout out to Neve.
I have a variation on that. This is a question that's just come through in real time from Kat. What is your best explanation of feminism when other women can't stomach the word because of what they've been told feminism is? So the pick me girls.
Yeah, right. Well, firstly, I would say that don't be disheartened if you can't convince them of it. It doesn't make you wrong. Because sometimes people, for whatever reason, it might be that they're just willfully ignorant. It might be that they're just too scared to expand their mind, particularly when it comes to pick me girls. They just will not listen to what you have to say. And so you can end up feeling really frustrated and disheartened. And those are emotions that suck energy out of you. Mm. So if you suspect that you won't change their mind, you don't have to stand there and try and convince them. You know, you don't lose any feminist points or cred by not being able to get one person over to the cause every day. But I guess I would, you know, some people just sort of go back to their basic definition, which is that, oh, it's just about equality between the sexes, which is not really true for me. I think it's about a lot more than that. I think that it's about the economic, reproductive and political liberation of all people from patriarchy, and particularly women. I don't know. I mean, it's tricky because it does end up being really frustrating, but something I like to say is that, you know, feminism is a movement that means I don't have to hate myself. You know, that it's about valuing myself in a world that tells me that my body is not good enough, that my, you know, I won't be paid more than men in the same field. My only role is as a mother, and once I become a mother, I'm, you know, an idiot. Or that if I don't become a mother, that I'm selfish. Yeah. It's about recognizing that I have the right to stand there as an equal and autonomous human being with dignity.
Mm.
That's beautiful.
Nice. That's really good.
Nice.
Well, that's something everyone can understand as well. You know, you don't have to have read widely on anything to just understand the world makes you want to hate yourself.
Yeah. And as we're seeing in New Zealand at the moment, and I'm sure this is kicking off in Australia, as is all around the world,
there are feminists who aren't including all women in that, which is one of our next questions from a listener who said, I don't really know how to phrase this, but in my head it's just TERFs, what the fuck? Which I've interpreted, why are so many cis women so fearful of making room for trans and non-binary people?
Well, because I guess, you know, cis women can be assholes just as much as anyone else, you know, and they can defend their territory or what they perceive to be their territory with exactly the same ferocity that cis men defend what they perceive to be their territory. I don't know why they're so afraid of expanding their mind, except that they're ignorant and they're fearful. And I appreciate that there's a lot of pushback against that now. I don't know. It just feels like a huge waste of energy and hatred, you know?
See, I'm surprised that it has gotten traction again, because the first time I ever heard the term, it was associated with Jermaine Greer, and I was like, well, you know, that's an older generation. I never expected it to be a movement that young people subscribe to. Not that I've ever really seen that many young people sort of talking about it. It's mostly been men and middle-aged cis women. But I'm just amazed. I'm amazed that it is, especially in Auckland, in New Zealand, it's just in the last few months, it's really become super visible, and it's a movement I expected to not ever hear about again. Well, and the thing that gets me as well is, this is probably like rose-tinted glasses, but I've always thought one of the physiological differences between a lot of cis men and women, or men and women, is our inherent empathy. I find a lot of women are more empathetic to what the experience of others might be like, even if they themselves haven't experienced it, as opposed to a lot of men just being like, I don't know what you're talking about, therefore it doesn't exist. So it's surprising to me then that there is a movement of women who cannot understand the trauma that so many trans men and women go through in their lives, and then want to re-traumatize them.
Yeah.
By telling them that, you know, they should define themselves in XYZ ways. It's amazing to me that women could act that way.
I don't know, because I think that that thing about empathy is maybe a bit of an illusion. And I think that that comes from the conditioning that women have to be empathetic, but really empathetic in a mainstream kind of way. So women will, their empathy might come from noticing that a colleague is a bit down today, and they'll be like, oh, what's going on? You know, let's sit down and talk about it. That's an act of empathy, sure. But we also know that it's true that like significant numbers of white women are not empathetic at all to the experiences of, you know, people of color. And not only not empathetic, but actively hostile to the activism of people of color and the expression of dignity and autonomy and humanity. So I think that it just, I don't know, like, I think that that's probably is a little bit of an illusion that's based on the conditioning that we have, but it hasn't actually extended itself to empathy for all humans.
Yes, sure.
Next question for you, Clementine. Best use of energy. How do you pick which trolls to tackle and or engage with, particularly for the sake of others reading who we don't want to be encouraged by them, and which ones do you leave?
Well, I wish I could say that there's, you know, a rhyme or reason to it, but honestly, sometimes it's just if I've got 5 minutes. most of them I just ignore, and, you know, just ignore them. They'll go away. They don't, by the way. Spoiler. No, they're always more there on the horizon. They're like, you know, flies. So mostly I just block and ban, or just ignore, or whatever, you know, because it is just a huge waste of energy. But every so often, if I've got 5 minutes, I'll reply, or I'll try and say something funny in response, or try and shame them in front of people. And then I might, where I might make a conscious choice about it is if someone says something that is so pointedly revolting or aggressive or abusive, that I then might screenshot it and make an example of that. You know, someone, I saw a comment today on my Facebook page of some guy saying that it was on a post about actually it was on a post that I'd shared a few months ago, it was an excerpt from the book, which was an excerpt from the final chapter, which is a letter to my son. And this person, this guy had commented that he felt sorry for my son because, you know, I was going to raise him to teach him to hate himself and probably force him to suicide. And so it would have been better if he'd never been born. Oh, and I was just like, I probably won't share that one because I think that that's just, I generally don't like to share stuff about my son.
Yeah.
But I just thought, you know, this is a guy who, if I made a comment so flippant about male suicide, would drag me to hell and back for it.
Absolutely.
Or if I treated male suicide as some kind of like political football, then I would be horribly called out, you know, and deservedly so.
Yeah.
And yet they have no problem. And this is like one of many comments that men have made to me about how my I will be. Another one was that I will be the reason my son kills himself one day. Like, how can they claim on the one hand to care so much about male suicide and yet at the same time almost be wishing for it to happen to just teach me a lesson? Yeah, to prove a point. Awesome. Like, why would their wish not be, you know, I really hope that your son grows up to be healthy and happy.
Yeah.
Mm. Even if they said, like, in spite of you.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. I really hope he ends up being healthy and happy as opposed to, well, he's going to kill himself one day and it'll be all your fault.
Yeah.
Mm. But is that part of that idea that some people have that the reason men experience a high rate of suicide is because women are so horrible to them?
Yeah, I think so. I think so. It's because they don't want to recognize that actually
it's the
drivers of that come from the expectations placed on masculinity and the expectations that men hold of each other to like perform masculinity and how they police it in each other as well, you know. It's not women doing this to them. It's women trying to liberate them from it. And the fact that they can't see that is – I think that, you know, a lot of them would actually – they're quite happy to be stuck in this situation. What they will not tolerate is being stuck in this situation and no longer having the fringe benefits of being able to politically, economically, and reproductively have power over women. Because that was the trade-off.
Mm.
You'd have to deal with all of this, but you can have all of this too. This is the cherry on the top of the shit sundae. You know, and it's interesting about the suicide thing as well, because if, you know, we were talking about rapist jokes is a better word for it, because if the rapist is the one most likely to laugh in the room, then it's a joke for them. But the overwhelmingly male comedy world bends over backwards to defend its right to tell jokes about rape and domestic violence and, you know, violence against women, things that they're statistically far less likely to experience as men. And that's fine because that's just words. That's just making light of dark topics. You have to be allowed to laugh about dark humor, blah, 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 blah. But if I stood up and started making jokes about male suicide, or if there were, you know, a contingent of female comics who just fixated on joking about men killing themselves, their response would be really, really different.
Yeah, absolutely. That is absolutely true.
Yep.
Shocking.
Another question. How can I talk to my 18 and 14-year-old extremely privileged nieces about their place in the world and what they should do to be good citizens? It's a tricky one, eh? Like, trying to make someone aware of their privilege for the very first time can be quite a challenge.
Yeah, and, you know, I don't have a lot to do with that age demographic necessarily. I mean, not personally face-to-face. I think that with that particular age group, sometimes it does help to be a bit sort of gentle in your questioning, which is a little – it's not something I'd recommend always. You know, I don't think that we need to go gently when we're trying to convince people of their privilege. But I suppose you could wish I'd had these questions beforehand. I think asking them to think about what differentiates their life from other people's is perhaps a good starter, but you want to make sure you don't do it in this sort of poverty porn kind of way, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
what are the privileges and advantages that they suspect they might have based on the circumstances of their birth. Mm-hmm. So talk to them about what it means. I'm assuming that they're white because of the question. Talk to them about what it means to be white in a country that still experiences, you know, that's a country that is historically rooted in colonization and that also still exerts racism and white supremacy over, you know, a good proportion of its citizens. Mm-hmm. Talk to them about what it means to be wealthy in a world where wealth is, you know, a differentiator. Wealth is the decider between who gets access to certain spaces and who doesn't. You know, talk to them about what it means to be mentally unwell, but to have access to, you know, private health insurance, to have access through things like your wealth and your skin color to treatment that won't marginalize you even further. It ultimately depends on how open they are to having those conversations. They may not be, which will create frustration and disappointment.
Mm.
But I think, you know, that as someone, you know, the fact that they're even asking that question shows that they're invested in the outcome of it. So it means that they can keep chipping away at it.
Yeah. And like you say, you can't solve everything in one day for everyone on earth, right?
Sometimes
things take time.
But I do think that the reality is that once people succeed in having their outlook changed, then it's very difficult for them to go back to their original way of thinking, you know. It's funny because in Australia I often use the example of banning smoking in restaurants and pubs to create social change. You know, when people are like, oh, well, this is just the way things are, you know, it's gender equality, blah, blah, blah. This is just the way men and women are. You say, okay, well, you think that we can't change society, but, you know, in 1996 in South Australia, they banned smoking in restaurants. And when that happened, people were like, yo, you're taking cigarettes out of restaurants. People will never tolerate that. They love to have a cigarette in between their meal. And then they took it out. And, of course, people adapted really quickly because it's gross to smoke inside. Mm. And then 10 years after that, in Victoria and in South Australia, and in fact, all over Australia now, they banned smoking inside pubs. And because you could still smoke in pubs up to that point. And people were like, well, they will definitely never tolerate that. People love to go out and have a beer and a cigarette at the same time. No one's going to go to the pub anymore. And, you know, Australia's still got a huge problem with alcohol abuse.
Yeah.
And if you lit up a cigarette in a pub now, people would be horrified.
Yeah.
Mm.
Now, in Victoria last year, they changed the outside smoking laws so you can now no longer smoke within a certain radius of where people are eating.
Yeah.
Which initially, you know, again, the same sort of outrage, but people, no, you've taken it outside of the pubs and we were allowed to smoke outside, but now we can't even do that. How dare you oppress us in this fashion? And I do smoke now. I started again when I was writing this book, so that's what that did to me. But I'm fine with those smoking laws, right? And I was in a pub in Wellington the other night in the beer garden having dinner, and I walked past a table of people who were all smoking cigarettes because obviously you're still allowed to smoke in alfresco dining areas here. And I wasn't, like, disgusted. I was just shocked. Yeah. I just thought, like, oh, why are they smoking out here? So that's how long it takes to actually create cultural change, provided you have the political will to do it.
Mm.
You just make it unacceptable and people really quickly will be like, not only will they adapt, but they'll also go, oh, why are they doing that? Why did that person say that really weird racist thing? Like, that's not acceptable.
We can evolve.
Yeah. And we're such – humans are so malleable and most of us are followers. Most of us want to be told what to do and we want to be given some kind of model of how to morally live correctly according to the crowd.
Yeah.
Mm. It's just about what decisions are being made by – the people with power around us as to what that morality will be.
But that unfortunately means that people are more likely as well to follow the Jordan Petersons of the world or whatever because they are looking for a moral path.
Yeah, true.
And
regardless of how bonkers it is.
Exactly. Not everyone that's offering the guiding light should be.
The best thing I ever heard about Jordan Peterson was that he's the stupid person's smart person.
Oh, my God, he is.
Yeah.
He really is. Our so workmate good. Is currently doing a Live Like Jordan Peterson week
yeah.
for a story that she's writing. She's eating the all-beef diet and only reading Jordan Peterson's 12 Steps to whatever. And I just find it so hard to believe that anyone thinks this guy is smart. Mm. Like,
I know.
He's a dum-dum.
It's too much yeah. beef. It's just too much beef.
It's too much beef in every sense, real every and sense. Metaphorical.
Yeah.
He is smart in one sense, and that is that if you create a completely ludicrous ideology that appeals to the most privileged group in the world, but mm-hmm. the one that considers themselves yep. Currently the most oppressed,
yeah.
you can make a fuck ton of money.
Mm. Yeah.
True. Good on you, Jordan.
Yeah. Shout out. Have you got any more questions from the page, Leonie?
Well, this, I guess, would be a good way to finish on a positive note because a couple have come through, Izzy and a couple of other people would like to know how you and how they can stay positive in the face of all of the terrible things that are happening in the world.
Mm. Well, I feel really positive in this room right now. And I think that is, I'm not being funny. I think that that's because it feels positive to me when I spend time with other like-minded people who understand what it is that, you know, we all have a shared understanding of what it feels like to be a woman living under a patriarchy.
Yeah.
And some of us have different experiences of other oppressions, you know, and, but on this one thing, we can get together and we can have a natter about it and mm-hmm. we can make some jokes and I feel like I'm going to walk away feeling really positive and taken care of, you know?
Yeah.
I hope you guys feel the same way.
Yes. Oh my goodness. Please, thank you.
So I feel like that's a really good act of self-care and it's something that I say to young women especially is that, you know, particularly the frustration that comes from being gaslit by the men that you know and even just gaslit in the sense of like, you know, if you're at school still and you have to go to school and deal with dickhead little anti-feminist shitheads who are like, oh, there's no such thing as a wage gap or, you know, like feminism is stupid. Have you read Jordan B. Peterson? Whatever it might be.
It's bad enough from a grown man, yeah. but from a 17-year-old,
oh,
it's
God,
intolerable.
It's intolerable, isn't it? When you have to deal with that and deal with them day in and day out and you are not yet at the point where you understand you're allowed to walk away and it doesn't mean you've lost anything. It actually means you're preserving your sanity because you're not going to convince them and they don't want to have a conversation with you in good faith, that one of the most important things you can do is spend time with other women and talk to them, talk in a space where you don't have to qualify your experience or prove your experience to anyone or check the words that you're using because you don't want to offend the men in the room or whatever it might be. But that's a really important thing to do. And it's funny that, like, you know, one of the sort of like fragilities of the men's rights and anti-feminist movements is this fear that they have of women's spaces. Like, women having a women's only swimming hour. Like, oh my God, God forbid women get to go to the local swimming pool and just swim with other women. Like, yeah. Oh, what about the men's hour? Like, fine, start it. Have a men's hour. Yeah. That's cool, dudes.
Yeah.
It's funny that, like, our attempts to kind of share space with each other in a way that is exclusive of cis men is met with all of this hostility, and yet people say, oh, well, you know, men's sheds are a really good idea because men can get together and they can talk in a safe space about their feelings. And they're like, it's so important for men to be able to do that.
And when we're not in our own spaces, we're being policed for what we wear, how we behave, what we drink.
And we're policing ourselves as well because it is so difficult to break out of the conditioning that you have had being socialized as a woman in the world to speak freely amongst men, to speak in a way that isn't preserving their feelings all the time, that isn't sort of like, it's like we've probably all had that, I don't do this anymore, but I had to train myself out of it. We've probably all had that experience of sitting down with, a table full of women in a pub or something like that and having a man approach and say as he's sitting down, oh, mind if I join you ladies? And what happens is that mostly women will go, oh, no, that's fine. And then they'll all turn their knees and their faces towards the man and in as an act of inclusion, you know, the man is here. The man is here. He's arrived to legitimize our conversation, and we can't continue talking about what it is that we're talking about because we might bore him.
Yeah.
Or he might think that we're
shallow or fluffy.
Yeah, or he might not think that we're pretty or whatever it is. Yeah. And yet I don't think that men necessarily do that. In fact, I definitely don't think that they've generally been conditioned to do that when women just unexpectedly pop up into their conversations, yeah. which we yeah. have certainly not been conditioned
yeah.
to do as a rule.
Yeah.
So that's something as well that I think is like an act of self-care. It's like checking all of the times that you're policing yourself in front of men and reminding yourself not to do it.
Yeah.
So when that man comes up to you in the pub and is like, oh, mind if I sit down? You're like, yeah, sorry, we're having a private conversation. And then just enjoy the look of confusion on his face as he realizes that like, oh, I have to get up and walk away now.
Yeah, I love that. I also love, which is something I have to do a lot, is like taking up more space.
Yeah.
In public, even if it's just walking down the street, not constantly like, I'm a big darter, like I dart away from everybody to make room.
Yeah.
No trouble.
I don't exist. I don't exist. I'm really not here. Or on the bus, like I try and sit like super gnarly now. I'm like, touch my leg. If your legs yeah. don't touch it, it's fine. I'm here.
Yeah.
But again, that's something I have had to like drill in, and I find it actually quite uncomfortable to do, but it's almost just like pushing through it.
I mean, it's interesting because I'm quite a tall, big person, you know, and when I'm on a plane, if I'm sitting next to, I'm actually the same size as a lot of men, but when I'm on a plane, like men's arms will just take the arm rests up, or their legs, of course, they'll do the man spreading thing because they need to make space for their huge balls. And so I try and do that now. I try and take up space because my instinct is to kind of like shrink myself into the seat because God forbid I be a woman who's the same size as a man because that's gross. And yet I just think it's funny that kind of like assumption that like, oh, well, I'm a dude, so I need to like take up more space. Yeah. It's like, well, I'm as tall as you, you know. My hips are certainly wider than yours. So I love that too, you know, like reminding ourselves that we don't have to apologize for existing in the world as actually physical entities.
Yeah. There's one more question, which I thought was a fantastic question that I think we'll end on. My question for you is, what are you not getting asked at book launches, panels, or morning TV that surprises you or that you are just burning to talk about that no one's ever bothered to ask you?
Oh, that is a good question. I don't know if there's any one particular thing, but I've been interested in, you know, some of the chapters that I wrote in this book that I thought would cause like a lot of discussion have kind of been like, we haven't really talked about the comedy thing, you know, and we have here today, but in panels, there's not a lot of discussion about the rape joke chapter. When I still see that as being a pretty important issue in the world, the casual humor that men feel entitled to make about women's trauma. I don't know. It's hard to sort of pick. I'd have to have a think about that, I think.
Yeah.
What do I want to talk about that's not being talked about? I guess one of the things that is sometimes asked that I would like to have more wide-reaching conversations about generally in society is not what women can do to help men in their lives get it, because this is always a question that like, what can I do to help my husband? What can I do to talk to my boyfriend about this? Blah, 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 blah. Like, we should really be asking the question of why so many women who sleep with men partner with men who fundamentally like don't agree that they are human beings.
Yeah.
But I want to talk more about what is the emotional labor that men can do and take on with each other to actually become a part of this change. I mean, to an extent, that's still an initial part of that will still be women doing that emotional labor, because we'll invariably be the ones who are driving that conversation. But at some point, I would like to stop talking about what it is that we as women can do to help men in our lives get it. Because we always hear, you know, 99% of men are good blokes and they would never do this, that or the other. But actually, I don't think that that's true. I think that most men are just really passive. They're really like happy to just sit back and claim that they're great, decent guys because they haven't raped anyone that they know of. When actually, like, it requires a lot more proactive behavior to be a part of positive social change and to constantly check the privilege that you have and how you may be reinforcing oppressive structures because you are a beneficiary of that privilege and you're not like engaging with it. And then to expect that women continue doing that work for you while you take the accolades of like, well, I'm a great, decent guy, and you're not actually being a part of creating any of the solutions, I think it's just bullshit.
Jeez. I can tell you where they can start. They can buy a copy of Boys Will Be Boys by Clementine Ford. Maybe at the Women's Bookshop even.
Yeah, great place
Proud
to buy
sponsor
it.
This fact, podcast.
Definitely buy it at the Women's Bookstore.
Definitely at the Women's Bookstore. Have you been there?
A wonderful place.
I have not.
Well, you're going to meet Carol tonight.
Yeah.
Because she owns the Women's Bookshop.
Woo-hoo.
So, yeah, so you'll meet her there.
That's wonderful. She's a legend.
She is a legend.
I'm pretty sure I met her last year, actually. Probably. I think that they did the event with me last year. But it was such a fly-in, fly-out visit last time that I didn't get a chance to go to the shop. Mm. But, yeah, do all your shopping there.
Do all your shopping.
Carol is a goddess.
Buy it for all the men in your life.
Yeah. And before you say, well, where's the men's bookstore? Start one. You know, if you want it so badly, do it yourself.
Get organized.
Exactly. Thank you so much, Clementine, for coming on this podcast again.
Coming back
I'm super thrilled to be back here. I love you guys.
Yeah, love on the rag page. So any questions now, just you can go straight to her. Thanks, Leonie, Michelle, as always, and the wonderful Tina for recording this podcast.
Thanks, Tina.
Bye, Boys Will Be Boys. Thank you, Women's Bookshop. Bye.
Haki te.
Ready to rediscover the joys of cycling? With over 300 kilometres of cycle paths across Tāmaki Makaurau, jumping on your bike and going for a ride is such a fun way to discover the city from a different perspective. Cycling is getting more and more popular across Auckland, so now's a great time to join the hype and give cycling a go. Head to at.govt/cycling to find your nearest cycleway today.
Kia ora e te iwi, Te Aihe Butler here, podcast manager at The Spinoff. If you enjoy listening to our podcasts, consider supporting our mahi by signing up to become a Spinoff member at thespinoff.co.nz/donate.
The Spinoff Podcast Network.